All right, there we go. We are now recording. Cool. We're up to episode 3 of season 11 of Mentioned in Dispatches. And Jim, you've been there for all 10 seasons before this. We appreciate you coming back again. Howdy and welcome.
No, thank you very kindly. Ever a pleasure.
And because Jim only agrees to be here with smart people, which means I got to bring somebody else to get him to show up. Mr. Cole Worley is back for another round with us. So, Cole, good evening, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
So, by the time this recording shows up, the results of the survey stuff will have been published. Some folks have seen that the solo gaming survey, the Solo War and Historical Gaming survey that we did with Beyond Solitaire, we were, you know, accumulating votes over basically the month of August, and then released the results. Again, you guys haven't seen them yet, but as this is it, other people are listening, it's about a week and a half old. Pax Pamir finished second on the list overall of favorite solo games, either purpose-designed solo or ones that people like playing themselves. So,
wow, incredible. Kudos to Ricky there. My goodness.
Yeah, so it's up there. D-Day at Omaha Beach was number one. You know, Butterfield showed up on the list a lot, as you can
Sure.
imagine. But John Company was also up there in the top 15 as well. So you represented well in the solo wargaming thing. And again, you know, some of it is the additions with the purpose-designed
Sure.
solo bots in there. But again, we were very particular about it doesn't have to be a purpose-designed solo game. If it's a multi-handed game that you enjoy playing by yourself, that's okay. Jim can't possibly fathom playing, but you know.
I'm being polite.
Other folks had fun participating in that survey. So I am going to take us a little off in a left field here, but there's a purpose to it. So guys, bear with me here a little bit. I've got a sports reference I need to pull in here. About 2 years ago or so, there was a guy writing over at The Athletic that was ranking the top 100 baseball players of all time. And he said he was ranking the top 100 baseball players, but some of the placement on the list was a little goofy because, like, Joe DiMaggio showed up at number 56 because of the hit streak, but Joe DiMaggio is not the 56th best player of all time. So he's talking about Nolan Ryan and, you know, great fireball, fastball pitcher from the 70s and 80s. And this is a quote for what he's saying, and this is leading up to a point here. Nolan Ryan was the greatest pitcher who ever lived. Nolan Ryan was also the most frustrating pitcher who ever lived. Nobody struck out more batters. Nobody walked more batters. Nobody was harder to hit. Nobody so willingly let base runners steal. Nobody threw more no-hitters. Nobody threw more wild pitches. He was unbeatable, and nobody in modern baseball lost more games. It's as if Ryan was not actually a pitcher, but something else entirely. An alien, a cartoon character, a folk hero, a saxophone. Trying to find a place for Ryan on a list like this is a bit like trying to figure out where the Beatles belong on your list of favorite pastas. And I bring this up only because it strikes me that Cole is the kind of guy who would know where the Beatles belong on his list of favorite pastas.
Right above Cavatappi.
Well, that's a long way of leading into. I'm expecting some weird questions showing up from Jim as well tonight, but it does strike me as kind of off the wall sorts of thinking that you sometimes bring to your game designs, and I don't mean that in a bad way at all. So I wanted to lead with that, and then we'll let the weirdness take over from there.
Excellent. What a prelude.
Yeah. All right, Jim, you get to follow that.
Yeah, this is sort of a piece with Cole. If you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be? No, I did come with my list. So here we go. Fire up. Nice to talk to you always. Always a pleasure. Love to see what you do. Love to see what you're writing about. I want to begin here, and this is leading over to ARCs. And I think you'll figure out how pretty quickly. Have you played Starfield?
No, I've been watching it though, which is a weird thing for me to do, but
I was going to ask you to explain yourself.
well, so it's real funny, right? I mean, streaming is something I remember wondering, like I was teaching a few years ago, and you'd always ask your younger students, what do you want to be when you grow up? And it was a great, like, you know, finger on the pulse, what are the kids thinking about? And eventually, you know, pop stars, et cetera, game designers often, but eventually, like, they wanted to be YouTubers, video streamers. And I didn't get it. And then when during COVID, I would be co-working with my friends where we were just kind of in Discord together and we'd just be working. And then eventually someone just started streaming their desktop. If they were working at a place where that was appropriate. And then, you know, it's lunchtime. We're going to play a game. We kind of stream the game. And it reminded me of just like hanging out in high school while someone played a Final Fantasy on the TV and you could kind of like lightly tune in or tune out. And I've noticed that if there's a game I'm really intrigued by, like Starfield, like right now I'm neck deep in graphic design. I get up every morning, I genuflect to my Adobe altar, and then I get in the weeds. And I've been listening to it's either been Starfield or like old Ultima playthroughs. thinking about open world design really is what happened. I watched a Starfield review and I was like, hi, is what Bethesda's doing, is it just like Ultima 7, like part 8 or something? Are we still stuck in this design trend? And so then I've been kind of like, you know, meandering around the odder corners of MS-DOS YouTube or something. Anyway, ask me your question about Starfield. I'm ready for
it. We used to have a thing when I was doing software development where we would sit around a brainstorm table, and if anybody came up with an idea, we would have to slide them a buck.
Okay.
You know, and it's like, well, that's it. There you go. Dollar. There you got it. I'm sliding you a dollar because you asked, you're almost answering the question I'm about to ask you. Has Starfield driven us? Because you, look, I know you know this. I know you believe this, and I know you preach and teach this. Design is Lord. You know, design is God, ultimately. All the other stuff, graphic design, awesome. And I'm going to have questions about that. Other stuff like that is great, but ultimately it's design. Mm-hmm. Has Starfield driven us into a blind alley where we're about to be mugged by our own disappointment?
I mean, yes. So there is, how family friendly is this podcast?
We
can I curse?
Officially age gate it, but yeah, we drop plenty of,
okay. Okay. So there's a kind of asinine, but also wonderful, digital magazine called Critical Inquiry. It was very popular like in 2012 or something. Sort of like filled with a bunch of disaffected graduate students. They published a piece on.
But you repeat yourself.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Every once in a while they would publish an essay that was just staggering, and they have an essay about Skyrim, and the title of this essay is called "Fuck Forever and Never Die," and it is about the dead end of the Bethesda School of Design, which is when you start taking open world design and you couple it with tremendous computational power, but also a tremendous amount of design infrastructure, right? The degree to which any game like Starfield could be produced is about as incredible as landing someone on the moon. I mean, it's such a large endeavor. But it's taking us to this place where the world can't have stakes, because when the players start making truly interesting decisions, it will undermine the design itself. And so in this essay, they talk a lot about Skyrim and the sexual politics of Skyrim, mainly the fact that, like, here's an open world where you can do everything, but do not procreate, because we cannot handle what that would mean for this world. Like, the world has to be like weirdly sterile. It has to be fundamentally a little bit more like Disneyland than like a world. Mm-hmm. And when what's remarkable about this is, you know, watching these old Ultima clips, they were already there. Like, you know, what Gary and his team were doing in the early 90s, they were at the end of the alley, and it may not have seemed like the end of the alley because we were still in like a pre-Daggerfall, you know, period. But if you're driven just by player intention, if you don't have a framing device for your game, you can't give it stakes. And if you can't give the game stakes, then the players are just going to kind of wander in whatever like weird garden you've built. And it starts being like a little anti-story, a little anti-narrative, a little anti-design, because there's no intentional vantage point or something. And so to me, it's like, it's Starfield, I think it's one thing to call it a bit of a dead end, but it also, like, it's more upsetting to realize the depth to which all of us are already like deep down that dead end. It's not that, like, if Starfield is bad, then video games for the past 15 years are bad.
Did we or did we not bridge that? You know, what's the line from Sartre that you have to the first thing you do is have to face the worm within. did we not bridge that though with Gee Whiz or with, oh my God, look at this, it's so cool? Because I was thinking about this in this framing. There's a couple articles on it. One of them is pretty good. Is Starfield is a game where everything is possible and little matters.
Yep, that's precisely it.
And it's a good piece. And I remember there was a distinct moment in Daggerfall where you could become a vampire. And everybody I knew was talking about it. Dude, did you get the visitor? And suddenly you were a vampire. Because it was a vampire that was visiting.
Okay.
And now you could go out and you would become a vampire and you could feed. And I remember thinking, nobody in this village is looking for me. I mean, yeah, if a guard sees me killing Cole in the middle of the street, I'm going to be in trouble.
Right.
You know, and my son is given to quoting the line from Skyrim, "Halt, you have violated the law." You know, that thing. You know, yes, you'll get caught. But there's no meta sense where the community gets together and goes, you know, they're not even playing the game vampire or werewolf, you know?
Right.
We're saying, let's have a town meeting. Okay, one of us is a vampire, right? We got to know that because everybody keeps showing up with puncture wounds.
Have the meeting in the Hall of Mirrors in Versailles. And
yeah, I mean, there's none of that. So I started seeing it. And have we, God, do I go so far? Have we sedated ourselves with, oh my God, this looks amazing. Oh, look where I can go. Oh, look at the things I can do. Oh, look at this procedural world that I created. That's the coolest thing you've ever seen. And ignored the fact that there's no there.
Well, there was an interesting moment early on in the development of Minecraft, like around, like really the first like couple years of Minecraft, where the game was done, but there really wasn't enough content so that you'd get bored of it pretty quickly. But I loved introducing people to it because we'd play Minecraft, and then within about an hour or two, they would have mastered most of the basic systems. They would have their little Wikipedia page up. They like knew how the crafting tree worked. And then they'd get really, really bored, like just recklessly bored. And they'd say, this game is nothing. And I loved that moment because certain players would realize that they weren't in a game. They were like in a sandbox. And like the game could be whatever we wanted it to be. And for some, it became this like the springboard to all sorts of amazing ludic experiences. But for other players, without another system to master, the game kind of shut down. And what's been interesting in the development of Minecraft, and this is to be expected, is as the design has grown over the past decade, that moment where you realize, where you have to ask yourself, what the hell am I actually doing in this design? It's now like 30 hours into the game instead of 2 hours into the game. And that's a bummer because I would rather players say like, hey, look at this odd space. Let's just play here in this odd space. And I always think about, you know, when sometimes people ask me about like, you know, defining a game or something, especially when I'm on college campuses, everybody always wants to define what a game is. And I always tell them that like, it's not a bad question. It's a question with lots of answers. And if you're expecting it to have one answer, you're going to be disappointed. But I always think about there are two definitions of games that I find are always competing in my own mind. One of them is, you know, a game is some kind of decision space that can adjudicate a winner. It's a box that you put player agents in and then it spits out a winner. And then the other definition that I really like is that it's any form of structured play. And I think oftentimes when I'm hearing people argue about what a game is, I just like they're caught in between those two definitions. And I just want to grab them by the shoulder and say like, hey, it's okay for there to be multiple meanings. It's not the end of the world here. But I think
your meaning depends on the context in which you're trying to apply it.
Right. Precisely. And so like, to me, one of the things that's interesting about Starfield, and I think this is true of a lot of Bethesda games is, what's the story like? What are the kinds of narratives that this thing generates, and how do those narratives build, you know, build upon the game's mechanisms or push against the game's mechanisms? And then you can start to think about like, okay, in what ways is Starfield truly different than the last Bethesda game? And I think when you start putting that stuff on the table, you're like, okay, this is a lot like the thing that came before it. And then what's slightly more upsetting is realizing that the thing that came before it is actually a lot like the thing that came before it. And then you start falling in this little trap where you go back to Arena or even to the games before that, and you're like, okay, so there's a world, there are factions, you're going to get quests, you're going to grow in the different guilds, and you're going to gain a bunch of statuses, and what playing those games for me, fundamentally, I think it's possible to tell stories as you play them. There are ways of telling stories as you play them. But what the game is interested in is basically slowly allowing you to punch past your way through every ride in the amusement park. Like I played some of the newer Zelda games, which there's nothing wrong with them. They're just not for me, really. But I had a great time with Breath of the Wild, but mostly because I was playing it in the most ramshackle way possible. Like, I was never completing shrines. I was always like barely like stumbling from one combat encounter to another. I never had like better weapons than sticks, but it was thrilling. I was in an adventure. And then, you know, I didn't get anywhere near completing it. I didn't see probably half of the content, but when I put it back on the shelf after having played it for a few hours, I thought, like, well, that was great. That actually made me feel like that was a good adventure story. And the other way of approaching that game is, how do I see every element of it? Which is, if you think about just a desire that an audience can have about a piece of media, is to me like crazy. Like, when you're, you know, when you sit down for see Hamlet, you don't need to see all possible Hamlets, just see the one and think about it.
So I got two different questions, and unfortunately they go in diverging directions. So whichever one I ask.
This is a very good Starfield. Exactly. This is a very good place where you can demonstrate the lessons of our last exchange.
But we probably won't get back around to the other question. So I'm sorry.
Right, exactly.
Which one I go for. So here's what I want to add. Then I'll go with this one. Given the relatively low stakes nature of, hey, you can't really change the world in any meaningful way, probably in part because then you get wildly divergent play experiences across all the different people trying to play. And there's not a lot of consistency when people are sort of comparing what they've done down the road. Is it time for the video game folks to potentially embrace some of what was popular in the RPG world in the mid and late 90s, and that is, bring back the meta plot, right? Bring back the continual advancement of the game over time. Now, I know the Destiny series has done that some, and I happen to know a little more about that because my son is a pretty significant player in that space. He's one of those globally ranked sort of dudes that, you know, the latest thing drops and he ends up in the top 1500 globally for finishing it kind of stuff. But, you know, Battletech had the clans coming back to the Inner Sphere. Torg had, you know, multiple different meta plots that unleashed over time. Shadowrun had the Harlequin meta plot that expanded over time. The Beckmead D&D had the Wrath of the Immortals that like sunk an entire continent as a part of their meta plot that changed the world over time. Is it time to put a couple of meta plots into those video games and let players sort of discover their way through them? And if you want to change your path, you're not going back to your previous save point. You're like literally starting the game all over again.
I mean, I think one of the funny things about the place where video games seems to be, and I'm speaking just as someone who plays them, of course, but they there are so many different design schools operating at the same time that you can find games that do that kind of work. And you can all, but you know, are those games ever going to be the big AAA games? I mean, I think if you look at the huge open world games that are, so you know, I guess they're the norm. I mean, when a new generation of console comes out, you're going to expect a big Red Dead Redemption 2 style flagship title that's going to cost $200 million. And in that genre of game, I mean, I think about those games as essentially amusement park games. They are, and that is a genre of entertainment. That is a way, I mean, I think when we get together and talk about games like that, we can sound like cinephiles talking about Marvel movies, right? Like, yeah, there are a lot of people who love those types of games. And at the same time, like, when I think about the way that they see their storytelling and the way that they see the way out isn't to think about the meta plot, but is instead to further burrow into the cinematic, the storehouse of cinematic ideas, right? They want to make the games feel more and more like movies, movies that are kind of generating themselves as they get played. And that, I mean, for my taste, seems like facile. I mean, I like the idea of a world disrupting event. I mean, I think that this actually does kind of happen sometimes at a larger scale. There was an amazing interview with the design team of XCOM 2, the newer XCOMs. And they mentioned that they set XCOM 2 in the kind of like fallen world because most people were losing XCOM 1. And so they said, okay, well, if we're going to set a sequel, we don't want to assume that players were successful in the first game. And, which I thought it was it's a lovely move because it did give, like, in a strange kind of way, stakes to how that first game went, as well as just being a good, a good perspective to build a game around. But I think, you know, I love that. I love the meta move. I love the, I love things that happen in a game because time is passing, and things that are slightly outside of player control, I think it's such a powerful storytelling device that, like,
we lack the courage for that though.
Right. I mean,
this isn't where I was going with this, but I feel this very strongly. So I'm going to say it. We seem to demand that level of player agency where I get to be the hero.
You're right.
And so if the plot in some way is happening around me or a story is happening around me, it better just be a roller coaster, right? I'm actually a little bit astonished that they had the courage to make the characters in it's going to escape me, the Left 4 Dead 2 remake that they did in the Warhammer 40K universe, that those guys aren't heroes. They're essentially throwaways. And yeah, they're not even good throwaways. They're Darktide. That's it. I had to look it up. Warhammer 40K Darktide. Now, it's a shooter. I get it. But these are not heroes in any traditional sense. In fact, most of what they do doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. If you think about the game at any kind of length, I just don't know if we have any kind of courage to embrace that in, as you say, a flagship tentpole game.
Yeah, I mean, it's fundamentally a very kind of experimental and strange way of thinking about the narrative. And there are places, I mean... Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that there's a funny, like, I have actually found the really interesting. I mean, I'm a huge fan of kind of traditional roguelike games, and it's because they never shy away from killing a player. Like I adore permadeath in games, not because I think it's an especially good mechanism. It's because of what it does to the storytelling. It gives characters ends, and it totally changes your relationship with the world and with the game because the world kind of like kicks you out of it. And so, you know, I think one of some of my favorite narrative work is, you know, happening in games like Caves of Cud or other designs kind of that ilk that are just sort of unafraid to sort of push players out of the game space and make you come to the game on the terms it's establishing. But that's not, you know, that's an interesting piece of design, but it's not anything that's going to necessarily, you know, a whole market is going to pivot on that.
I knew you would feel this way. I'm glad. Well, I suspected you.
I've been baited. I knew it.
You were baited. So what did you do to Ark?
So Arx is a funny design. I mean, I think it it's impossible to talk about it without talking very briefly about Oath and what Oath tried to do. It does.
Yeah.
Oath is I mean, it's so funny. I mean, sometimes when I come to Patrick and ask for money, which is often because I think about the way my I mean, so look, I'm the creative director at Leader Games, but I still think it's important that if you want to do a project, someone should have to approve it. So we have this consent model where if we want to undertake a big project, we need to get the buy-in for the studio. And if someone on the team doesn't want to do it, they are going to be they have to be explicitly kind of like overruled by someone who's higher up in the pecking order. And we do that because I don't want anybody to have like a freebie. Like I don't, you know, when I was working on Arx, I thought like, okay, well, I'm going to go to the customer service person to explain this project. And if the customer service person doesn't sign on, instead of asking Patrick to overrule them, I'm going to be like, no, what are your concerns? Like, I actually want to talk to this person and kind of build a consensus around the project. Because I know that when we're building these games, that poor customer service person, they're going to be playtesting with me. And after the game's out, they're going to have to do, you know, customer service requests for the game. And so, you know, when I was starting to work on Oath, I told Patrick that the premise, like the game essentially was built on these kind of two design goals. One design goal was that I wanted the game to end dramatically. I didn't want there to be kind of like anticlimactic finishes generally in the game. And then because I felt like Root sometimes had the most interesting turn in Root sometimes happened like 2/3 through the game. Mm-hmm. And then the last turn would be a little procedural. And that actually, most war games are like that.
We're all comfortable here. You're my friend.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll say in most 18XX games, which I think are games that also have very interesting dramatic arcs, they are almost always like the last operating rounds in 18XX game are incredibly boring. Unfortunately, they're sometimes also very important. So you're doing this thing where it's like, I've got to do my taxes, but and they might matter, but in a way that there's no like player choice. And so I said, look, I kind of want to fix that. I would love to have a game that had these more dramatic finishes. And then the second thing is I really wanted a game where the end states of the game, of a game could also be a start state. In that second like thing, I mean, it sounds so simple. It's like, hey, look, I want the way the game ends, that should also be a start state. Mm-hmm. That's something that games like just do not do. Like a game system, it's like a little entropy system. It's like everything's running out of energy. Like chess is a great example. If you just think about potential moves in chess as like energy, as you play a game of chess, the board state, it just all the energy is leached out. There's mm-hmm. no way to put pieces really back on the board outside of the pawns. And even then, like you're going to run out of those pieces. And so I said, okay, well, let's just think about what it would mean for those things to be true. And when I told that to Patrick, I said, I think this is going to be difficult. I think it'll take 3 to 6 months to figure out if it's even roughly feasible. And then that will tell us what the execution is going to be like. And I worked on it for a little over 3 months and then said, okay, I think to execute it, it's a 2-year project, probably. Maybe 18 months if we get lucky. And I mean, I'll avoid doing it, but I could really go into the weeds about like so many elements of the game were designed at a very high level and not high as in lofty or interesting, but high just from a conceptual level where if the game had to change at a certain pace, it could only have so many cards change. You know, there are all these like weird narrative requirements in the design that were baked in even before we actually started doing the actual primary game design. So anyway, Oath, that's 2020's game. Worked on Oath, we executed it. It turns into this giant project. And when I, after Oath was done and I helped with some Root stuff, I went back to Patrick and I said, all right, Patrick, I want to work on another game kind of like Oath, but with a big difference because Oath is fundamentally gradualistic. Things change slowly. It's like erosion. And that's part of why it works, but it also never ends. It doesn't have any narrative framing. And that is a costly thing. That means we have this big, interesting story generator, and there are stakes, but the stakes are fully player determined. A player might really care that a certain part of the world is going away or whatever, but the game isn't telling them to care. And because every end state has to be playable, there are things the players aren't allowed to do. The world can't get too busted up. It can get pretty busted, but it can't get too busted up. And I told Patrick, I'd like to make a game that actually does have an end. And ARCS had like a few very simple concepts. One concept was I wanted it to be a campaign game, but only 3 or 4 episodes long. And that was mostly just my feeling as a player. Like I didn't want to make a 40-hour game. I wanted to take a big TI, you know, game and divide it into 3 little sections. And that was partially a reaction. And this is a little bit of an aside to a tendency in modern design to compress games and make them very small. And so, you know, I think a good example of this is the very recent game, Roy Cannaday's game, Lost Light, Last Light, mm-hmm. Which I have feelings about. But it is symptomatic of an effort to make games as frictionless as possible. It wants to be quick. That's its primary design imperative. Every little bit of that design is like, wow, they wanted to, how could we resolve it faster? And I thought, well, no, I like the TI is long. I just can't play it because I have children. And so what if we divide TI into smaller bits? And then when I started doing that, I realized that most of TI was actually very boring. And I like TI a lot, but it's kind of a goofy shaped game. If you like look at it very, like if it were a movie, nobody would watch it. And So that was like one kind of like broad imperative. And then the second one had to do with the notion of giving players a little bit more control over what the game could be. And so Arx was about, it's about this really fundamental problem with asymmetric design. This like very, very, it's funny because Arx and Rooter are so different games, but they're actually addressing like a very similar question, which is, and this is slightly tangential to the question you asked, but in asymmetric design, asymmetry is, it's not something I like designing. It's expensive design wise. It's going to make testing harder, writing rules harder. People will hate learning it. I would never recommend a young designer to like work on an asymmetric game. I just think it's like, why would you try building a car that big? Like start with like a motorcycle or something.
All right, Volko, you're on notice. Okay.
Yeah. And Volko, we could talk about how the coin games, both how they get around it and the places where they don't get around it.
Okay, it also wasn't his first published game.
No. And well, I mean, Wilderness Wars, it also has a lot of.
I was about to say
asymmetry is present in Wilderness War, but you can't really make the case that Coin was his first game.
Sure, for sure, and I think Volko is a special case because if you all have talked to him, I'm sure you have. That man knows what he's about, he certainly. Can conceptualize all that stuff. But what I realized was when you're working on an asymmetric game, it's not something that you should spend design budget on eagerly, but you do it because the world is an asymmetric place. There are stories work because characters are different from one another, different in fundamental ways. And so when you allow some of that difference to kind of percolate to the surface and to inform a game space, you start getting access to these amazing stories. However, as the asymmetry grows, players stop playing the same game. And Root is right on the precipice of this. It's right on the edge. But I realized that, in order for Root to work as a game, there needs to be some kind of space where we can all meet. And in Root, it's warriors and rolling dice and fighting battles and all. It's geopolitics. But that meant that the only real language you could use in Root, the players could only talk in battles. And I thought, well, this is like if the worst Star Wars movies are the ones that are all battles, the better ones have all the other different storytelling devices. When I think about, the narratives that really work, they are about a lot more than just violence. And so I needed a different kind of asymmetric framework for telling those kinds of stories. And the problem was, as you know, if one player is a doctor trying to cure a disease and another player is trying to evacuate refugees and a third player might be a warlord, what do they have in common? Nothing. And so Arx, the design of Arx was all about finding that a common game space that could knit these different asymmetric positions together so they could be actually playing game together. And then to have a framework that was flexible enough that the asymmetric positions could grow and change over the course of a campaign in meaningful ways. Because so I wanted it as a way of both showcasing asymmetry and also explaining it. And the hope was that when you start doing that kind of work, that's going to give you access to the really good stories and the really good design systems. I mean, like when we were talking about Starfield, I mean, the main thing that we were all kind of flirting around is the notion of stakes. Mm-hmm. The notion that you're going to take a decision, something's going to happen. It's going to change the way the game works for everyone that comes after you. And really that is the central question that Arx was trained on. How do I make it important for me what you did? And how to do that in a way that isn't just, oh, you destroyed my castle.
Well, I'm sure somebody's talked to you about this before, but I don't know that it's come up on one of your visits with us. But where do you stand on the idea of the legacy board games and sort of the semi-permanent nature of the environment that you can make some meaningful changes in the board game that ripple beyond just this play?
I mean, my general attitude about legacy games is I think it's a good idea that's been badly implemented. Boy, that sounds way too harsh. That I'm not going to retract that statement, but I'm going to qualify it because
I'm not sure it's harsh enough in some cases, but okay. Well,
So the problem with risk legacy is that it's still risk. And so
exactly.
you're building these things. The storytelling is exciting, but fundamentally you're just playing a game of risk. And as like Rob and his crew have built more bespoke and intriguing legacy formats, in order to get that narrative juice, they've kind of leaned into a cinematic frame for their storytelling. But Pandemic Legacy works really well because Pandemic is a very robust design that can handle a lot of small changes and still be Pandemic. But you're still playing Pandemic. And so the stakes, I mean, I always think the Pandemic Legacy games are especially funny because, like, here we are trying to cure diseases. But if we cure them, then there won't be anything to do in the next round of the Legacy game. So you're like caught a little bit in this very funny loop. I think it's not so dissimilar from a loop that is similar to, you know, AAA video games and things like that. But I think when I started playing historical games, you would occasionally run into people who had been playing games for a really long time. Like you would run into, there was a group in Austin who had played like a long diplomacy game, like a multi-year, like 20 player, big epic diplomacy game. Mm-hmm. And the way they talked about those games was fascinating because there was history and texture and layers to it. They were participating in this like grand game experience that seemed a lot more, I don't know, like narratively coherent than the kinds of experiences that you get in a legacy game. And so part of the problem, I think, has to do with, I mean, I will say now, I mean, I think Arx is as close to a legacy game as I will probably ever make. And it has been a tremendously difficult project to work on because the core chassis has to be tremendously robust by itself and also has to encapsulate every single possible combination of all the different things that can happen in the game. But when you strip down that all those different things that can happen, that core chassis has to be really good, because otherwise you're going to end up in a seafall kind of situation where the game sort of does become quite interesting in the later stages, but then in the early stages it feels like you're not doing anything.
No, nobody knows that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I did a thing,
including myself, parenthetically, he says, looking at his copy of Seafall.
Well, I look, if you have a copy of Seafall on your shelf, which you may not have opened for the last 6, 7, 8, 10 years, I recommend considering the following. Tear it open. Look at everything. Treat it like a book. And then either pack it away or recycle it. Because there's a lot of cool stuff in that game. And I think that Rob did a really good job with it. But I also think Rob didn't. I think that there were certain things about the experience. And it's funny because I was reading Rob's, what a wandering answer this is, but I was reading something Rob had written about like encountering Seafall again with a little bit more perspective. And I think it's very interesting because Rob and I are probably, we think about as differently about games as any two people. He had all these lessons about like getting to the fun faster, focusing on the parts of the work, all that stuff, which is fine. And which I think will probably produce, like, Seafall Second Edition will certainly be better than Seafall First Edition. But Seafall Second Edition will almost certainly be a retreat into a safer, more controlled way of doing Seafall. My attitude about working in this space is that if you're going to let players change the game, you need to build a game that can be changed in really like fundamentally meaningful ways. And I think, you know, Oath is an interesting case with that, because I think Oath gets close, but it's also a design I want to spend more time on and add some things to. Because I think I've learned a lot from the players who have sunk a lot of time into Oath and who have gotten to that 30th, 40th game where the game starts getting really weird with how the decks are composed. And I think, oh, I can help players get to that stuff a little sooner. Anyway, it's a big wandering thing, but the core of it, the core point is, I think, you know, there is, when you sit down to play a game of Dune, I'll use Dune as an example, because Dune, I think, is one of those extraordinary, perfect asymmetric designs.
Okay, and it's so asymmetric you're talking about the Avalon Hill original?
Yes. Okay. I mean, the Gale Force 9 was nice, but the core Dune, the like, you know,
yeah, okay.
The Eon Dune. Yeah. I think Dune is one of those asymmetric designs that it almost says like this, here's an ecosystem. Here's how the market works. Here's how information works. Here's how troops work. Here's how troops move. And then it builds its asymmetry around the ecosystem, around that core ecosystem. And that's like, to me, the fundamental thing that makes Dune great is that its player positions aren't different for different sake. They're different because they are owning a part of the core system of the game. And then, I think when I've been thinking a lot about Dune as I work on ARCs, not just because of science fiction and the setting notes and things like that, but because as we work on ARCs, you know, I talked to my co-lead in development, Josh Earsley, who's also a great wargamer, and the editor, and he and I often talk about Dune and thinking about ways to have that kind of system, that kind of world system, emerge as you're playing the design, so that as players play, kind of new currencies and, you know, economies sort of open up, and the players kind of position themselves in those new systems. And so I try to think about it like, you know, fundamentally campaign play, I put legacy games kind of under the campaign umbrella. It's about telling the story of something. And I want to look at something like Dune and say, like, was there a game that players were playing, a hypothetical game, that would arrive in Dune being like game two or game three in a campaign game? They didn't start playing Dune. Maybe they started playing Borderlands. But by game three, it was looking an awful lot like Dune. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what the next game would be like, because if you know, if Dune ends and the Fremen have kicked everyone off the planet or something, like, what does that next game look like? And so ARCs is like trying to do that episodic storytelling, but in a way that is letting players procedurally generate the game systems. And here, I think, you know, I adore a lot of proc gen stuff. I mean, obviously I love roguelike games, but what I'm trying to do with ARCs is not, I don't just want players to procedurally generate a flipping map. I want them to be generating the game itself. And the mm-hmm. and by the game, I mean like fundamentally the system that suspends the different player positions.
Okay, well, this is where I get to be rude to the guest.
Be rude.
So how can you charge people more for something that reads like it's essential?
Oh, so that's a very good question. And I'm going to provide context for your lovely viewers, because you're probably me asking me about why the campaign game is an expansion.
Yeah.
This is a funny thing. I mean, it's not really a funny thing. It's a thing that what was so obvious to us working on the game that when we announced it and some people got flustered, we were surprised. ARCs, when we were working on it, I was spending a lot of time thinking about what's the core system? What's the core? It has to be, if an individual game is not good, I don't care if the campaign's good. If someone tells me to skip the first season of a television show, I am never watching that television show, period. Yeah. So as we were working on ARCs, so all this campaign stuff, all these high and mighty goals, they were all floating in our minds. But what we were playing on our Tuesday and Thursday and Friday playtest sessions was a shortened version of ARCs, because we had to make sure that the core engine, we were kind of like working in a proof of concept engine, we had to make sure that could consistently produce a really interesting, tense strategic and tactical experience. And we were working on the campaign stuff, but in a way that was weirdly secondary to that core loop. And then when we got on and we started actually, so what would happen is we'd get that core loop good and strong. And then we'd say, okay, here are all of our campaign ideas. Let's plug them in. We'd build a version of the campaign. And it would work sort of, but it'd be overwhelming. And so in fixing it, we'd have to go back to the core game and adjust it. And then we would work on the campaign game some more. And that would give us ideas about the core game. And then the core game would give us ideas about the campaign game. And so there was this loop. But at this point, we weren't really thinking about the core game as a core game. We were just thinking about it as part of this very large project. And then what happened was the core game, it just got better. It was consistently getting better, and we were finding a lot of members of staff didn't really care about the campaign. They weren't interested in a large experience, and they loved the core game. They were like, this is the best game you've worked on. This is one of the best games the studio's produced, but I really have no interest in the campaign game. I just want to play the core game. And I thought, well, that's that's sort of fascinating. Let's try, like, what does it mean to decouple these two experiences? And the other thing that was informing me was that we were finding that we were building the base game, not quite as a tutorial mode, but what we were finding that basically when I told players, I mean, Arx is a very peculiar game. It's probably the strangest thing I've worked on. I've worked on a lot of odd games, but like what it, like Arx is so mean. Like you will have a turn where nothing happens, where you just are completely ruined, and then it'll happen again. And it, when you can dial into it, I adore it to death. A little bit like, I mean, it's such a game from the 80s. Like it just has this very, it's very loose with how it handles the player. It's a little rough with its players. But what we found was it was peculiar enough that players needed to learn the core systems first before they got wrapped into the campaign. There was just no way that you could just throw someone into the full campaign. And that part of that was happening because the campaign was starting to get more interesting and the different things that it could do were diverging farther and farther and farther away. But if you had a player who like didn't know how to fly their little spaceship, throwing them in the campaign game was just a wreck. So around that same time, you know, one of the things that I have to do in my capacity at work is think about how we're going to sell these games and how we're going to produce them. I spend a lot. It's actually like, I feel very lucky because I mostly get to think about the cool things I want to build, but a big portion of my professional life has to think about things like product lines and how much does it cost to produce this and what size box is this going to be in? And as we were answering those questions, it was clear that there was kind of no reason to put everything in one box. Like it didn't make any sense. And then there was this question of like, well, do you think that base game, would it survive in the market? And one thing that we would always ask ourselves is if someone comes to us at a convention and we're selling games, I want to be able to hand them something that they can probably play that evening, ideally. And one of my favorite things about Root is I can tell people like, hey, here's Root. Like, watch an online video, read the rules. You could be playing it this afternoon. Mm-hmm. And with Oath, Oath was our pandemic baby, and we could never really say that about Oath. And Oath like never got a release show. Oh. Our games usually.
Oh dear God! Yeah.
Yeah. Come can on. You imagine? No, hey no. Guys, can we play?
Oh, Oath I can imagine. You see, I'm that guy who says, hey, we're playing this game called Empires in Arms tonight. It'll be great. Come on over.
Right. But core arcs, you could. And so we started thinking like, okay, well, actually, this is like $150 project or $200 project that we're building. It doesn't need to be that though, because there's a big chunk of our audience who are not our Kickstarter audience, who are not like probably the folks listening to this podcast or y'all, who actually don't want to eat the whole cake. They want a piece of cake. And so as we were getting this stuff together, we realized like, okay, these are actually two games. And one interesting thing, and I'll say this, I always have regrets about the way we build a Kickstarter, how we structure things. My biggest regret about Arx is that I think it's right to split the product. I think absolutely it's right to split. It's obvious to split the product. I don't think we should have split the pledges. Like hardly anybody backed it for just the base game. Because of course, when we go to Kickstarter, people want like, what's the cool thing you've been talking about? Well, yes, that's the thing we want. And I think what happened is we split the product so people could back it at a low level and then back it at the higher level. And then what that did was beg the question. I mean, the question you asked, Brant, which is like, why aren't you giving them the main thing? Yeah. And what I want to tell them is like, you are getting the main thing. It's just, there's part of that, the main thing is this other game that you need to play first before you can play the main thing. And you might decide that there is so much in the base game that you're good for a while. That's also fine. And so it's a lot more similar to a relationship between like Pandemic and Pandemic Legacy, or between like, you know, Arkham Horror, the card game, like the initial campaign, and, you know, getting two or three campaign cycles at once, then it is like a demo mode. Because
I'm almost thinking it's less of not so much a game comparison, but it's the difference between playing a game of tennis with your friends at the local neighborhood court and a tennis tournament on the tour, right? I mean, there's a much bigger ecosystem around it versus let's just go play tennis. We're hitting balls back and forth. We're keeping score. Same lines on the court. Same mechanics.
Right.
But what are you wrapping around it?
So, you know, when you open up the base game of Arx, it's in a box the size of Root. It's got a board, it's got pieces, it's a very full box. It's going to be about the size of Root, maybe a little bit taller. It is packed. you're also getting 8 asymmetric powers and a deck of 14 powers, which you can use to draft your own player positions. It's a very competitive game. It's incredibly mean. And it's a 60 to 90 minute game. First games are going to be a little bit longer. There is just a ton of meat in that core game. Now, when you go to the campaign box is going to be about twice as tall as the Oath box. It's got 400, 500 cards in it that are structured into 24 plot lines. It's got a bunch of extra pieces in it. It's got a big storage solution so you can capture the board. And you can, if you want, put your boxes together. You can combine everything in just the big box. That's the, and the box is designed to hold everything. But I actually think a lot of players are probably going to want to keep their base box so that if they're just going to the club, they can just take out the pieces they need to play a base game and just take it down to the club. I mean, it's a little bit, I mean, this is, again, this is, it's the most wargaming thing imaginable, right? Like, you know, I've got my ASL starter kits. They get a lot more play than any of the other ASL stuff. And I'm glad they're in a smaller box.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not quite, you know, fantasy flight size boxes, but, you know.
Yeah, but it's in, you know, I think it starts to be in their company a little bit. We had a fascinating pricing conversation because that's the thing we have to think about. It's like, okay, well, you know, obviously the production cost is determining a lot of things, but there are many factors in determining a game price. And it was pretty obvious that the base game would be priced at the same amount as Roots in the same size box. It has the same amount of, it has a lot more content actually, but it's about their products I would want competing at that level. For the ARCs campaign expansion, originally we had thought about pricing it at like $40 or $50 or $60 because we had this rule that like you don't want an expansion that costs more than the base game. But as we worked on it, I was like, no, it's in a box twice the size of the Oath box. And I brought in an Arkham expansion with the investigator pack and a full campaign. And I said, this is $100 and ARCs is twice as big as this, the ARCs expansion. So like, I feel pretty comfortable charging $100 for an expansion that is of this size because it's more like Beyond Valor than it is like Starter Kit 4.
Yeah. I was about to say, if you're saying that the expansion shouldn't be bigger than the base game, you haven't been hanging around the ASL guys.
Right. Exactly.
The 11th season of the Armchair Dragoons podcast, mentioned in dispatches, is graciously supported by all of our Patreon supporters who pledged at the top level. A huge thank you to Chet Bell, Hellcat6, Patrick Geraghty, Fred Stogg and his walking companion, Mike Quigley, Joseph Knorr, Trep Corey, Stagger Wing, Mark Talk, and Kevin Bertram for their support of the Armchair Dragoons, which helps us bring you the best strategy gaming content on the web. You too can sign up as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
So what do you say to those people that say, drop the component quality in the base game and give us the campaign instead?
It's just doing that. I think they... I think that this, I mean, I hate to make this particular move, but I would want them to play the game first because the base game of ARCs is so robust. It is so interesting that I think if I, even outside of the campaign game, I would put the base game of ARCs like up against anything I've designed. I think it's as interesting of a game as like the second edition of Pamir. It's not as goofy as John Company, but that's what the campaign's for. And I think that,
it's, you know, my feelings about John Company. So.
Yeah. I think that it's, you know, I get very excited about the experimental stuff and the narrative elements and the like broader enterprise of these big, big game projects. But I love the in the trenches work of just, you know, meat and potatoes, game design and development. And ARCs is about as best as I can do, the core game. And it's the, it is the kind of like stripped down framework on which a lot of other things are built. And, you know, when people play Super Smash Brothers, they turn off the items and they play on the same goddamn stage always, right?
Yeah.
And I think I think about core ARCs as like a little bit like that. It's the same game that holds all of the different characters and all the different personalities and all the different feelings, but it is taken to its simplest set. And if I've got, you know, a free afternoon, I'm gonna play an ARCs. ARCs is, it's smooth and it is intriguing. And when I've got more time, I'm most certainly gonna be playing the campaign game. But the critical test that I gave myself was that the base game had to be good. If it ever felt like a tech demo, if it ever felt like a proof of concept, it was not going to be good enough to split into its own thing. And there were times when that was true. And we hesitated to split those games off. But the longer we worked on it, the more it found its own footing and its own identity.
Is it weird to you ever that you have produced a game that people were willing to back to the tune of $1.5 million?
It's consistently weird. Every product that I've ever put on Kickstarter, I always assume is going to kind of do less well than the previous one. Drew and I
would think that, but go
well,
ahead.
I mean, it's because I've got this Midwestern, you know, sensibility to it.
Oh, it's no good. It's nice, it's, sweetie.
Yeah. No, it's funny, right? I'm gonna really doom myself for saying this, but we never plan expansions for games at Leader Games until after the game has been out a year, mm-hmm. and it's because I think we're all. Even though we come to work with the bright eyes of optimists, in our Lutheran hearts, we're all pessimists. And we always have this thing where we kind of get to be like humble and surprised at our own success. But it means, from a customer standpoint, that our expansions are always coming out like 2 to 3 years after the core game, which is horrible business practice. And Arx was actually the very first game where I said, as a project, what would it mean to design the expansion stuff, not exactly at the same time as the core game, but right afterwards? So like Arx is future-proofed in a way that Root and Oath were not. I mean, Root, I thought we'd never expand. Oath, I thought we'd never expand. And so every time we expand Root, Josh and I have to go in the rules and just sister all the joists and put in a bunch of support.
Yeah.
And like we've written those battle rules, rewritten them so many times to make sure that they're holding all the different like ways that, you know, they can be modified. And Arx is the first game where we really thought about what is actually the next wave of content look like? Can we do like, and so Arx is funny because I feel very, very good about how much stuff we have to show. But in terms of the total universe that I think can be explored, it's probably about half. And so if we wanted to do more arcs and if the game does well, we'll be kind of ready to be like, yeah, here's the stuff about, mercenary companies that like we couldn't fold into the base game, but it can be there because we knew that we wanted to do it eventually. And we kind of like put those plugs in. But I still get to be, quite pessimistic about it because that's my job. You know, Drew and I are getting ready to, a couple weeks after this airs, we'll be launching the Malyaus campaign. And I think tomorrow we're announcing the date. It'll be in the middle of October. And just sort of typing the like opening introductory little essay for that game, I'm writing like, well, I don't know how well this is going to go. This is something totally new for us. And I really genuinely don't. But at some point, you just have to put yourself out there and see if they, you know, folks want to keep you around for a little longer.
So if Jim rolled up to you with, you know, $5 million and said, hey, Cole, I need you to go historical for one here.
I need you
to get out of, you know, making it up yourself land. And I need you to go historical.
Yes. Making it up yourself land.
I mean, that's where I live. Yes.
And, but no, I mean, like, you know, you set a counterinsurgency in a petting zoo and got away with it and became a runaway hit. And like now you're, you know, off on other planets with Arx and, you know, Oath doing its own, you know, cosmology behind the scenes and all. But if Jim showed up and said, all right, you got to actually do something historical here. Here's $5 million. You got 18 months. I'll see you, you know, come back to me when you're ready. Where are you going and why is it not the Napoleonic Wars?
It's because my French isn't good enough. It's really pretty bad.
We have people for that.
Yeah.
By people, Jim means himself.
But yeah, so there is here is my governing rule, and this really informs all of my design, historical and otherwise. If I think of a market segment, I hate to even use that kind of language, but if I think a type of game is being really well served by its current design ecosystem, then I usually don't have any interest in working in it. I love train games. But I think 18xx design is in a really strong place. I don't need to be figuring out how to make an 18xx design. And I feel that way actually about like a lot of war games. I think wargaming in many respects has like never been as good as it is right now. And it doesn't need me in this in the way that when I work on something like ARCs, I think, you know, I mean, and look, I love Rob, but there are a lot of and I love, you know, Eric and a lot of the people who work in thematic mass market games. I look at them and I think, you are not really making the games that I love. And so there is a type of game that I feel like is not being made, and it's more like Root and Arcs than it is like Seafall and Rising Sun, although I like Rising Sun a fair bit. With the historical games, though, I mean, this partly then kind of explains why I make the weird historical games that I make, because when I was working on the Opium Wars games, there were literally zero games on the Opium Wars. And I thought, this is a fantastic, interesting subject. Why aren't there games on it? And I remember when I first started working on Pax Sumer, there was a Compass game called The Great Game that had been announced. And I almost stopped working on Pax Sumer. Because I thought, oh, someone's making a game about the Great Game. Good for them. Excellent. I don't have to do this now. And then I kept working on it anyway, and I can't believe I think the second edition might have beaten it to market. this was like, it was probably back in 2014 or something like that. So the historical games I want to make are the ones that are in those kind of underserved places. So there are things like Molly House, which I've worked a ton on. I'll probably end up sharing Joe's design credit with him because it's been such a fruitful collaboration and we've had so much fun going back and forth because there aren't a lot of games about like the queer history of London in the early 18th century. It's a great subject because actually it's about
the when you birth. Say aren't a lot. It's
yeah, I was gonna like, say. Yeah, I mean, name the other one.
Yeah, sorry, exactly. Yeah. Well, everybody know. It's a funny thing because I mean there are hardly books on the subject. But it's a great subject because it's about the history of policing. It's about how respectability culture kind of is born. It's about coffee houses. It's about social spaces in cities. It touches on all these major themes that are well trodden. And you know, the other projects that I'm really excited about are, you know, I want more games on municipal histories. I want more games on nation building that are actually about the problems of nation building. I mean, this is why, you know, I've talked to y'all about my kind of never ending game on Reconstruction that I really want to work on. I mean, that's my answer to the direct answer to your question is if I could clear my plate and just work on one project and I could only pick one, I would do a very large design on American Reconstruction. Like it's a huge project. It would take a lot of time, but I love the project because it's fundamentally a game about the history of nation building. And it's also a game where you can just, with a piece of string, connect so many problems and elements of our own society just directly back to it. And I think it is also very well appointed to a game form to explore in a way that it isn't a movie. I think that you need player agency to tell that story properly. So that's
the kind of stuff. Not aware of it, but there's actually one of the students out of the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth did it's only ever going to get as far as a rough design because of the nature of the course there. They've only got a year to work on it around everything else. But his master's thesis for his master's in military art and science in wargaming was a four-sided coin-inspired game on Reconstruction.
Perfect. Well, now I don't have to do it. Well, maybe I'll reach out.
Because yours will actually get published and his won't. So
sure. Or maybe you connect me to this person. Not that I need more products to work on right now, but that's, I mean, I think those are the kinds of things that I really like doing. And because I have my hands in a lot of pots right now, those things still happen. They just happen very slowly. And that of course is how, I mean, John Company was a 10-year project. And the way I kind of think about it, someone asked, you know, if I had made much progress on the Reconstruction game, I said, well, it's moving about as fast as John Company moved, which means it'll be ready in, you know, 6 years or something. You know, because I'm reading, I'm taking notes, I'm kind of thinking about it. I don't need 6 years of active design work. I probably only need like a year and a half. But I want to make sure that I have like a firm sense of how it's going to sit. And, you know, Drew and I, we're in a funny place right now with our little venture because, you know, my brother told me he's contending with the fact that our whirly gig is turning into a whirly career. You know, he quit his he had a wonderful job at the Chicago Botanic Gardens that he quit a few months before the pandemic began to work full time on Whirligig stuff. So he does it full time. That is his job. And I, you know, Pamir is on its fourth print run and John Company is, you know, in second or third print runs now. And the titles are doing well. And we're just trying to think like, well, what sort of games do we feel like if we are thinking about this, not as this is a weird venture that the two odd brothers are running on a weekend, and instead think, what are we trying to offer to the broader space of historical gaming? And I really like that this funny little niche that we've carved out, which is, you know, somewhere between GMT and Fort Circle, we have these kind of like odd curated games that are about very specific themes that are kind of being pitched towards, you know, pretty narrow audiences. I mean, I love Kevin's work at Fort Circle has been spectacular. Shores of Tripoli is an incredible game, and Votes for Women is like one of my favorite games from last year. But I know that Kevin is doing games that are going to be have pretty broad appeal. They're going to be a little lighter than the kind of things I work on. They're also going to be finished a little more quickly than the kind of things I normally work on. So, you know, if I'm looking at Joe's initial design for Molly House, I told Joe that the only advantage he had for signing on us is that we would go slow. And it would be a very full contact development where we were really going to, you know, sort through it in all the angles, but we were going to go slow and we were going to preserve its strangeness. And I'm glad, I think that they're, you know, you want at least one publisher like that in the historical gaming sphere. I don't know if you could handle two or three, but you want at least one. And I'm happy to be, you know, to be helping out.
I'm just still stuck here thinking about your reconstruction game, because that's such an obvious, and to me, it's an obvious gap in our, what do we want to say? Historiography, our ludiography.
When I used to teach A-Push,
I did not realize my son is currently in A-Push. Okay. I had never heard. I took A-Push when I was in high school a certain number of years ago. That is sure. More than 10. And I'd never heard the acronym. So there are the connotation.
It's the funniest. Yeah. The funniest connotation imaginable, A-Push. But I taught a study seminar that was it was kind of like a shadow class where you would take the class before you actually took it.
Yeah, yeah.
And we would get to it. We'd get to Reconstruction. And I would start talking through it. And the students just had, it was weird because there's something I think quite sinister happening with how we think about Reconstruction, where it's not just, I think you're right to attack it at the level of historiography, because it's not just, this is a period people don't know about. This is a period that it's hard to even teach people about. Like, not only do you not know about it, if you learn the concept, you have nowhere to hang it as if it were a coat. You have nowhere to hang it in your closet. It doesn't stick to anything. It doesn't connect to anything.
Right.
When it is in fact, I mean, this is why the frame that I've always liked to use about it is, you know, I think about the United States as fundamentally a nation that has a failed state about three times, two or three times. And I think it kind of fails right out the gate with the Articles of Confederacy, right? And the Articles of Constitution. And then it fails again in the Civil War. And then it sort of fails and rebuilds itself in the First World War. And mm-hmm. every time that happens, the state fundamentally changes. It's a new nation. But one of the weird things about the way US history gets taught, but more importantly than taught, imagined, is that there's a weird time skip where Americans, myself included, know a lot about the late 18th century,
mm-hmm.
right? We could recognize the first few presidents, and then there's a lot of blurriness and maybe Lincoln. and then maybe there's World War II. We've seen some of those movies, and then we're at the present.
Right.
But it's this very weird thing where it's like, no, like what, the nation as you know it, as you exist in it, it really traces itself like back to the period of Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
I think a game is a particularly useful way of telling that story, because you like there's no better way to get players to, or to get, you know, a student, a reader to inhabit something than giving them a story to kind of hold on to. And Reconstruction is filled with stories, but also it doesn't have, like, it has no media presence. It's so strange. I wish more people would read Chernow's Grant biography that was very popular a few years ago.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a good biography, But it's also like one of the best introductions to Reconstruction. I have an uncle who reads he's everyone's uncle who reads a lot of history is what he is. But he and I disagree politically on lots of things. But I was talking about Reconstruction, and it was strange because he was a person who's pretty well read, but he didn't like have a good hold on it. And we book clubbed the Cherno biography together. Mm-hmm. And it was great, and it was a great experience for both of us, because we could see, it was like we were uncovering this missing link of our own, our own national composition. And then I'll say, as an aside, I am tremendously interested in it because as a system, as a tension, questions of nation building, of troop logistics, the political calculus, all that stuff is so ripe, and it's exactly in my wheelhouse. That's the one I want to work on.
Given the socio-political conflicts in the real world that have spilled into gaming, do you think there's actually a market for such a game?
I'm sure of it. I am so sure of it. I think this is, war games are fun. I think games generally are an instance of when you build it, people come. There's you have to make a case for what you are doing, but players are compelled by learning, and they want to learn they want to learn a place, a time, and attention. And that was, I remember there were a lot of people when I was working on Pamir who said you were picking the worst theme to start your design career on.
Now I would have said that only because I would have put myself up as the standard and said, I'm really interested in this game. Oh, it will never succeed.
Yes. a game of that, I'll never forget that the geek mail I got, a game of that title will never be published.
Between that and Gen Company, you're lucky to have sold two copies.
Yes. But, when I think about Pamir, I think, this is a game about Borderlands. We love stories about Borderlands.
Yeah.
And I think about John Company, and I think most of history, to me, the success of John Company is a very simple recognition that the most important frame for understanding the contemporary period is the institution. And we need a better way of using that frame or transposing that frame into game spaces. So we need to tell games about institutions. We need to play our institutions. We're good at playing nations. We're good at playing armies. We're good at playing heroes. But most of the major actors of the modern period are institutions. And John Company was to me, it's the first, or if you think about Republic of Rome being the first, it's the second stab at a kind of institutional, game, an institutional game. And the thing I hope from John Company is I want to see more games. I want someone to send me a game like, this is my game about, the chocolate industry in Pennsylvania, or this is my game about Canadian logging companies, that is actually about the history and less about some cute, Euro mechanism or something.
No, I've made the point. I think your point about the Cherno biography is really important, because, to be honest, I find it a bit hagiographical, which I'm willing to engage in with Grant because I feel that way about him.
Yep, I agree on both those points.
I think that the rehabilitation of Sam Grant has been one of the great stories of the past 30 years in American historiography.
Yeah.
But that having been said, I've been in conversations where people who adore Sam Grant were willing to be drawn in by the Cherno biography and then be led and say, and now do you think about what happened in during Reconstruction?
Yes.
And suddenly went, whoa. And they had to reevaluate some preconceived notion,
mm-hmm.
because they had been led by their affection for Sam Grant, for the narrative of the Civil War, for all this. Well, then what happened after, as we lost the peace?
Yep.
I got to find $5 million to have. Yeah, to
do this. Well, though, I mean, the thing is, fortunately, you don't have
to. Because I want to play that game now. We really do.
We have Kickstarter. No, this is why we're happening. The thing that I just to take a step back, the John Company was an exceptionally taxing project, and as if that it was taxing both because it was big, but it was also coming right on the heels of Oath, which was also taxing.
And are you talking second edition?
I'm talking the second edition. The first edition was hard too. The second edition was very hard, and it was very hard for lots of reasons. the going from the second edition of John Company to ARX has been a thing I would not advise anyone to do. I feel like I'm on three large projects in a row, and this is a funny time for y'all to be talking to me, because I am in so thick. I could share photos on my phone of just me surrounded by like plotter paper of all of the different color variations on pieces in ARX. We are. Like ARX is a big enough project that when we start the pre-press process, which is submitting files to the factory, it literally takes 2 months. We are doing like a file every other day. It will take about, I think it's closer to a month and a half to get all those to the factory approved, checked, and then we go into production. And while that's happening, we're doing final balancing on the campaign content. And I get to work every day at like 7:30, 8 at latest. I am there till 6, and it is full. I am lunch at the desk. We are in it. So that if I'm stepping back, I've got these three big projects that I've finished. And then as Whirligig has shown this sustaining audience, what we have found, well, Drew and I have this question where we want to answer, and this is related to the Zenobia contest, which will be running again this year, starts in early October. Very excited about. We want to see if we can use the little audience that we've built around my games as a platform for other games like them. And that to me is the most pressing and urgent question in my design life right now. Basically, like the success of Molly House will tell me, is this a the platform we built, can it be shared? And if it can be shared, excellent. We will hire a developer. We'll figure that out. We will get this little body of games that we've been kind of working on together. We'll get them to print. And I'm hoping that the answer is yes, because it will give me time to work on the next big historical game, because Molly House has taken a lot of work and I'm very excited about it, but a lot less work than ARX or John Company. And as you know, I am happy to do graphic design and help with design and development for those games. And there's a bunch of them. There's a game about the history of Singapore. There's a game about the Sacred Band of Thieves that a designer is working on. We've got lots of intriguing titles that folks have trusted with us, with the explicit condition that I tell them, I have no idea this will ever be published by us. I don't know. but if you want to just kind of keep it in our wheelhouse, we're happy to work on it. As soon as I have clarity about that, it will start giving me room to think about when and how do we do the second edition of Infamous Traffic, and when and how do I start attacking the Reconstruction game in a more serious way. And so those are all questions that are going to start getting answered, I hope, this next year, because, you know, after ARX is out, if the title does well, I have to do some expansions for it. I'm going to be helping with Root and Oath stuff, but that stuff is easy and controllable and gives my mind time to think about bigger and more complex games, because I want the 12-year Reconstruction game that starts in 65. You know, I want that big, kind of like wide viewed look that asks the hard questions about why Reconstruction failed, and maybe the harder questions about what it would have looked like if some things had gone a little differently.
I'm going to ask a question for Jim here. Jim, you had to put $500 down one way or the other. Which one comes out first, Cole's Reconstruction game or Le Grand Battles?
Are you talking about the Command and Colors expansion?
Yes.
That will never come out? Okay.
That will never, ever, never come out. No, I mean, my answer on that question is I want Le Grand Battles to come out very, very much, but the gap that is represented by a game on Reconstruction is so great that I think it has actual value in the intellectual space served by games. I mean, I'm putzing around with the British Way Counterinsurgency at the End of Empire by GMT. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Steve, I'm going to pronounce his name wrong. I'm looking at the box here. Steve Rangazas, I think. He's done I call it a yeoman's job.
Yeah.
Through it. And God knows, and I mean this quite sincerely, we needed a game on End of Empire, particularly stuff that nobody considers, you know, the Mau Mau in Kenya, the situation in Cyprus. I mean, I'm an obsessive viewer. If you've never seen it, the BBC's End of Empire, it's available on YouTube. Watch it. Anyway. You know, that's got real value to me. But to see something that moved away from a coin structure and really tried to explore Reconstruction and what it meant and who the players were, and tried to represent equitably their motivations in, you know. My money's going that way. It just is.
Part of the problem you're going to run into with something like a Reconstruction game, and so obviously it's easier to get away with in the British way, because at the end of the Empire, like those four conflicts take place in four very different places on the planet, right? The Palestine and Cyprus are kind of close together, but they're completely different actors in both cases.
Oh my God, yes.
Part of the challenge you're going to run into,
I mean, other than the British, of course, but
but part of the challenge you're going to run into with Reconstruction is you're almost going to have to steal some mechanics from Small World, because there are factions that come and go throughout that period of time. Yeah. And there's the four factions you start with aren't the same four factions you end with. If you're just going for the, you know, if you're starting from the four player coin paradigm, which there's no reason for you to necessarily do that. But if that's where you started, the same four factions that you end with aren't the same four you start with. Like some of those, you know, some of them fall away, others rise to take their place. It's probably not appropriate to conflate them all. So unless you have like an 8-player game group and just tell four of them to show up halfway through the game,
right?
Figuring out how to, you know, how and when to shift people from one to the other. And I know Brian Train and I sort of kicked around a couple of ideas for actually a Lebanon thing that we were just spitballing one day. It was during the lead up to the podcast, and I really wish I'd hit record, because it would be a lot. There were a couple of really good ideas that were thrown around out there, mostly by Brian, because he's a lot smarter than I am. And but we didn't fully capture everything. But essentially, you're not playing the factions, like you're playing the different sort of corners on a spectrum. You're the you know, international authoritarians versus the, you know, religious authoritarians or whatever different things. And so the factions are actually tools you use to try and pull the country in your direction. So you as the player are playing sort of a political philosophy rather than a specific faction in there somewhere. And so that's one way, like getting around this whole idea of the factions come and go, because that's what happened in Lebanon also, right, over time. It is, you know, these Christian militias rise and then they disappear, and the Marines show up and then the Marines leave, and then the Israelis show up and then they show up again, and then they show up again, and then they just won't go away, and then they sort of stick around and then they leave for a bit and then they come back. And so, like, how do you model all these different factions coming and going, and mm-hmm. rather than try and make the player the faction, we said, well, why don't we just make those the tools? And then it went absolutely nowhere, because Brian's way too busy, and I'm much more of a slacker than Brian is. So,
well, I mean, I think that
ended up here.
I think that the British Way is probably the most important GMT publication in years. I think it is such an interesting package, and I have had such a good time going through all of the supplementary materials, which I think are very well prepared.
Yes.
But the strategy is fascinating. To say, okay, we're going to talk about post-colonial situations, or, you know, the post-coloniality, really. Mm-hmm. And we're going to do it not in an extended meditation, but almost in a collage, like these case studies. And it's fascinating, because the way, you know, Brant, listening to you talk about sorting through Lebanon, and even just the notion of games with large scope, one way you get around that is you say, well, we're just going to focus on one flashpoint. And then instead of trying to do continuity from one flashpoint to another in the same place, we're going to go a few thousand miles east and do a different flashpoint. And I think that's an extremely compelling way to tell a story. It's not appropriate for every story, though, right? Like if I'm talking about the collapse of the British Empire, I think the British Way probably does as good a job as any game on the market of just trying to explain the sorts of situations that were being mm-hmm. created. But the broader context, why any of these situations has gotten to this point, the game does not even attempt to explain.
Yeah.
And I think its focus is both admirable, because I think its focus is it's almost like it wouldn't work if it were any bigger than it was. And I haven't done the little campaign thing that is associated with it.
Oh, the End of Empire thing.
Yeah, I've just done the individual moments. But to me, like one of the problems with the game at Reconstruction is, like, you kind of, the minimum length of the game, it needs to be about 12 years. Because if you make it any shorter, it's too easy to take take the wrong lesson.
Yeah.
And that's like part of the problem, I think, is thinking about, I mean, and this gets into the pedagogy of the Civil War, is that I remember when I was in high school and it was time to talk about the Civil War, I was so disappointed that like the first week was spent on like the Missouri Compromise. Mm-hmm. And we were like, oh, we're still in the 1840s. Oh, now we're in the 1850s. And it's like, oh, here's the Civil War, something, 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 Gettysburg Address, Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln gets shot, Civil War units over. And I actually think that that's just backwards. I think if you had to pick, do you talk about the causes of the Civil War or the aftermath of the Civil War? If you could only choose one, you pick the aftermath.
Yeah.
You start the Civil War at Bull Run or Fort Sumter, wherever you want to start it. And then you go into the 1870s and 80s and you say, this is the Civil War. The reason it's not taught that way is because cause and effect get a little muddy. And it gets a little hard to kind of sort everything out. It's a lot easier to tell people like, well, there's these states' rights folks and talk about, you know.
Yeah, I was about to say, you're going to no shortage of people, you know, storming the school board demanding that history be rewritten on their behalf.
Right.
And like it's happening anyway, but it's happening without actually like telling the truth ahead of time.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think also, though, you've got a problem of simple chronology.
Yep.
Usually American history is broken into two halves. Mm-hmm. And that half is not, as it should be, at the Civil War. It's at World War One. So they're so constrained for time.
Yep.
that piece, that critical piece from 1865 through, I guess, Wilson, I guess I'd say.
Sure.
Is tends to get dumped just because teachers are out of time. Yeah. I've said for many, many years, and I'm not an Americanist, I'm a Europeanist. You know, it's the same exact problem, though, when you break up European history in a curriculum. It's the fault of the curriculum as much as anything.
Right. No, I think that's absolutely right. And I think there are very well-intentioned, like, so for example, in a push curriculum, as you probably know, you want to include more Indigenous history, ideally, which Absolutely. Means you're now stretching that first yeah. unit further back.
Yes.
And
yeah, exactly. And you're right. It's like you're doing the right thing. And yet when you get to the, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a funny, yeah, it's a funny thing.
Cole, you having actually taught this probably have a better perspective on it than us, but my limited experience actually, you know, being a history student, but also, you know, having watched my father teach it as well. I wonder if part of it isn't, you know, trying to make connections with the students that are in front of you, and things post World War One are far more recognizable to them
sure.
than things pre World War One, that it's very hard to really draw some meaningful connections to them because it's just not something they can relate to as easily. And, yep. and you know, starting with, let's face it, most Americans don't get the difference between World War One and World War Two, which is a little pathetic, right? We fought the Germans in both, so therefore it's one giant
right.
thing. And the fact that we still have some veterans running around who lived through World War, you know, fought in World War II and lived through that they've got, you know, this is lived recent history for people that we can walk up and talk to. It's a little easier to make those more relatable, that maybe that's why they're kind of leaning on that a little more for the students, because they know they can actually get some attention out of them for that.
Right.
It's a lot harder to, you know, care about 1840s fur traders because there's yep. just no frame of reference for those kids.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is an interesting curriculum design that you see occasionally, which is an effort to teach it backwards, where you kind of start at the present moment and you yes. say like, okay, you know, this Supreme Court case just came in, let's like go through it and start pulling things together. The problem is, you know, that really only works if the students already have like a bare framework. And this just gets into, you know, I think some of the core problem with history curriculum is it's just being asked to do too much by too many folks, right?
Well, for an audience that fundamentally doesn't give a shit, which is unfortunate, yes. but
yeah, I mean, it's yeah, yeah, yes, yeah, precisely.
I mean, the three of us are outliers in terms of people who care about history, and that we've probably engaged with it a whole lot more than people that even know something about history, never mind the people that just don't have a clue. So
yeah, no, I think, I mean, if I could be king of the world or whatever and rewrite curriculum, I'd probably have students take civics classes first. And then, you know, you start backfilling the history where people might wonder, you know, why we have separation of powers, and you can kind of sort through that a little bit. You do a little bit more case study work. And then when they're ready for a survey, I mean, this is a little bit, you know, in the humanities, it's very common for surveys to be taken after single author studies or after thematic studies. Like if I've got English majors, and this is probably the part of curriculum I know the most, they're going to take some class that's going to be called like Monsters and Mayhem in Victorian Literature or something. And it's going to be three or four authors, and it's going to be kind of relaxing. And, oh, maybe they got kind of excited about Mary Shelley, and they take a single author class just on Mary Shelley or just on George Eliot. That's wonderful. And now it's like, and now you're ready for a survey. And it's the same when you're reading history. I mean, I always tell folks, if you want to learn about a period, find a biography, a short one, because when you read a biography first and then you read a general survey, it's like you're going to a party where you already know someone.
Yeah.
And it is so much easier to get a handle on the whole history rather than just sitting down and saying like, okay, well, I'm just going to sit down and read this, you know, 1200 page history of the Pacific War or something.
Well, yeah, and in the way in which a biography personalizes things,
yeah,
and you know, maybe this is part of what helps with the war games, is that it personalizes things by engaging with them on that more personal level. It definitely personalizes things and gives you a narrative to hold on to. Like you said, like you're going to a party where you already know somebody. The problem is you can't test a biography on a bubble sheet.
Yeah. Right?
I can test names and dates and sequences and, you know, how long did this last? Because I can put 7 different years range in the bubble sheet, whereas I can't put, you know, the friendships people had and how this experience influenced somebody else's thinking. You can't build that into a bubble sheet. And so, you know, we end up teaching to the test or the testing mechanism, which is, you know, sucks, but it kind of,
yeah, it's anything that done to standardize and improve education is also going to come at a cost, right? Yeah. So like, it's one of those things where, you know, it's nice that we can actually compare curriculum and test results. That's good. It just comes at a steep cost, maybe too steep.
I was when I was in grad school. So this is, you know, mumble something years ago at this point. The working on a master's degree, one of the classes we had to take was the media law class, right? I'm working on a master's in journalism. There's a class on media law. I took it over the summer where it was actually a combined class with the grad. There were about 6 grad students in there and the rest of them were undergrads. And so 3 days a week, 4 days a week, we had our regular class meeting. And then one day each week, the grad students, we'd go grab lunch and then we'd reconvene for an extra 2 hours with the professor. And that was when we got into the more detailed graduate studies component of things beyond just sort of the survey stuff that the undergrads were doing. I expected many of the undergrads to not have a great grasp of some of the concepts of American history that were being discussed, because some of these kids hadn't got to all of their U.S. history classes that were required even in the general ed program. I was astounded at how little U.S. history the grad students knew. And that was a little painful because, look, you're in grad school, like clearly education is something that matters to you. Going to school is something that, you know, you're willing to endure enough to, you know, start putting yourself through extra college. That you know, just the desire for some level of basic knowledge would have been there. And like, these guys couldn't accurately identify all the players in World War One, like the countries involved in World
right,
War
One. Right.
It's like, really? I mean, come on now. I was stunned by that. And, you know, I wasn't surprised by it in undergrad, but I was really surprised by it in grad school. That really sort of bugged me in ways it probably shouldn't have, but it did.
Yeah. I mean, that and that's something that I found in graduate school, too, where you just run into these big lacuna where you're like, I can't. It seems like you should know about these things.
Yeah.
And I think it's a little bit of a symptom of the specialization of fields. There are a lot of elements to it, but ideally you just want people to be in a searching framework and at least to have a sense of what they don't know. And I think that's the part, you know, I always tell folks that the best thing I learned from graduate school is I started to understand the shape of my own ignorance. Yeah. it's really the biggest difference, because a lot of times you can get through an undergrad degree and not really realize how much you don't know. But boy, I certainly learned that in graduate school. And so what I would always try to impart, especially to my high school students, were like, okay, I'm teaching a little bit of history to you. And I don't know how much of it's going to stick, but if I can get one thing to stick, it's just to say, you know, past another country, it's complex. There are a lot of reasons why people feel the way they do, and, you know, be patient with it and just, you know, have a little bit of a sense of where you should, like what kinds of things you should do to start learning about the thing you're doing. And that can include playing some war games.
All right, we're well past the 90-minute mark here and probably need to start wrapping up. You guys have the benefit of still having another hour left in your evening to go do other stuff. Some of us on the East Coast got to get up at 5:30 in the morning to get kids out to school. So, Jim, I'm sure we only made it like three bullets into your 12-point list of things you wanted to ask Cole. I'm going to give you a last question here, like throw something else at him, but not something that's going to take another half hour to go through.
Yeah, I'll keep my answers to it. It's more than half my
fault. I'm not concerned with you, Cole. I'm concerned with Jim taking 12 minutes in the lead up.
No, actually, I got to a lot of the things, and you intuited some of them in terms of, you know, what would you do if you could do something historical? And of course, it's something I'm terribly, terribly excited about. So no, I covered the ground I had hoped to cover, and I enjoyed it very much.
Well,
can I ask you a question, Jim? The one thing that we didn't talk about that I thought we were going to talk about. So last time I was here, we talked about the Zucker Napoleonic games.
We sure did.
Which I've been playing, and my brother and I have been bopping around other wargaming systems. So we did great campaigns. Mm-hmm. American Civil War, fabulous design, utterly unplayable in person, just so many status counters. Yep. And yet the design is brilliant. But I keep finding myself coming back to the Zucker games because they are so clean. Anyway, the question I had for you was, have you given any attention to the Marcus Stumpner Last Battles Napoleon variants of the Zucker games?
Yes.
And would you recommend them?
Yes.
Okay, cool. That's it.
What they really go after is the CRT.
Yes. Yes, they do.
You know, because as we discussed, I think, in our last get together, the Zucker CRT is one of its greatest. It's a feature. Let's start there. It's not a bug. You know, if you ask Mr. Zucker this, he will not disavow it. He will say, no. He believes it is what it should be and is working as intended. Right. And it is also the thing that most divides people. I know Kev Sharp, who's a very smart fella, likes board games a lot, plays a lot of them. Cannot stand it. Cannot stand it. Thinks it's wrong. It's a fundamental historical disagreement about the nature of the beast.
Yeah.
So I will say, and forgive me, that's a long way of answering a very simple
question. It was a very self-serving question on my part. And it was one of those things where Drew and I are probably going to play some more this fall. And I was like,
yeah, crack them out.
Yeah,
crack it out.
Just try
definitely
it.
I mean, do just you use understand. The chip bowl? Yes, I do. Okay. Now, do I do it? Have I done it? Yes. Do I do it? No. Just because when I play online, is people want to play with the Zucker rules.
Sure.
And do not doubt, and not that this will matter one fig to you, but it is regarded as heresy by those who love the Zucker rules.
I don't know where I fall yet, because I have found a lot to admire in the Zucker rules. But I haven't decided. I'm not a partisan on either side yet.
No, and nor I, to be honest. I mean, like I say, I just because I like having people to play games with,
sure.
As Brent intimated earlier, I do not understand solo gaming whatsoever. I don't like it. I don't do it, and I don't pursue it. So,
how many people are you playing Baldur's Gate with?
Three.
Okay.
Excellent. I'm a man after my own heart.
You know, I think it's a far, far better experience. It's a social experience. It's what I want to do. I'm playing it with my son and my best friend. But yeah, and by the way it facilitates multiplayer play gives the further lie to, no, you do not have to play these games by yourself. You do not. Stop saying that. But no, back to your point, because I want to be able to play with multiple people, you sort of find what the tribe has decided to do.
Yes.
And those are outside the pale. Now, if somebody were to bring it up and say, hey, let's play it this way. Yeah, I've got that kit too. So
cool. All right, excellent. Good. Well, I'm glad I got to ask.
Well, glad we got to help. So it's not often that like the guests start peppering us with questions.
I love it.
Watch out, bro.
There are times I wish it would happen more often just to get a little more two-way traffic, because there's times when I feel a little too Larry King, and like I'd like it to be a better conversation instead of just us, you know, kind of interrogating people that, you know, throw some stuff back at us. It's totally cool. I love it when I've got a panel of folks on, when I've got a couple of different people on and they start asking questions of each other. Like that is really cool.
That's perfect.
Yeah. Not just because I end up with less to do, but you know, that's nice. But I think you get some more interesting questions there than sort of, you know, Brand or Jim just working through a checklist, you know? So, cool. Well, look, Cole, thank you very much for like giving up a bunch of time to join us on this. I do definitely appreciate it. And, you know, the whole thing wandered off into some odd cul-de-sacs, but that was totally cool. That's part of the shtick of our podcast, right? You know, a couple of gamers sit down at a bar, hit record. What do you come up with? So I think that's very cool. And I appreciate you giving up some time to join us for that, especially given the work hours that you've told us about you're doing these days.
It is absolutely my pleasure.
And one of these days, look, I know SD Hist is like, you know, your cultural touchstone around, you know, conventions just for fun as opposed to for business. But once we get the Fall Assembly down here in North Carolina ramped up, you know, a couple of years down the line, we're going to see if we can't drag you down here to come join us and play some more games just for fun.
That sounds lovely. And I've never been to North Carolina, so it's on my list.
We'll make sure there's some catered barbecue in there for you somewhere too.
All right. Excellent.
So you can grab a slab of that while you're here. Our first one is happening this year. As people are hearing this, we're probably about, you know, a week or two in the future. We're actually hosted at a game store this year, just, you know, to try and get the first one off the ground. The game store is helping us out with some space. And you know, it's sort of the anchor store that we use around here, which is Gamers Armory, one of the better war game stores in the country. And you know, we're hoping next year that we outgrow the place. They're hoping we outgrow them, but just mainly because that means we're being more successful. And so you know, we're hoping to get into a real convention space and have some fun with it, you know, building going forward. So cool. Jim, thank you for joining us. We're going to bring you back once budget season is over, because by then the Compass catalogs will be showing up.
And, awesome. We need to
generate some more hate mail from Compass Games. So, you know, we're going to say lovely things about them for 2 hours, and they're going to find like the one negative thing we said and like yell at us for it. So
there you go.
Happens every year, man. It's a tradition now. So audience, thank you very much for joining us. We say this evening as we record it, but thank you for joining us whenever it is you're listening to us. You know, Fred out walking the dog or whatever's going on with you. So thanks for being here. Thanks to Cole. Thanks to Jim. And we'll catch you next time on another episode of Mentioned in Dispatches.